Hello and welcome to 18 Groups podcast, exploring the real challenges facing the future of the RegTech industry, taken from the keynote address by Peter Moss, CEO of SmartStream RDU, at the recent RegTech Summit in New York on the 15th November 2018. Entitled Garbage In, Garbage Out, Why RegTech is Only Half the Answer, Moss explains that accurate data is the foundation upon which everything must be built, and explores why an appropriate focus on data is crucial in order to ensure the regulatory processes function efficiently.
For those of you here this morning, this is going to be a return to actually a very familiar theme that we covered in the panel earlier on. You never quite know how those panels are going to go and what you're going to cover. So what I am going to do, I think, is actually summarize some of what we talked about there. And then try and put it into the context of how much opportunity there really is for RegTech and other providers around the regulatory industry. Because I think the bottom line is that the theme that seemed to be coming out of a few of the sessions earlier on was that it's actually quite difficult to get into these organizations and actually make a difference. And I think the MIFID case study that I'm going to walk through actually gives a good example of how it can work, and it can work very well. And firms are actually quite comfortable relying on others in the right context. So let me start with the title slide, which I can skip, with a step back. I think, as we're all very well aware, it's been a bit of a dash over the last 10 years after the financial crisis, with the frantic introduction of many regulations, and not surprisingly, a lot of firms in the industry have really had not much choice but to just get things implemented. The risks of not actually getting on top of the regulations and doing whatever was necessary to actually make it to the starting line was too great to actually do anything different. And as a consequence, a lot of firms have ended up with, I think, very tactical approaches. There are a few firms, undoubtedly, that have done a very good job, but a lot of firms that actually have put in place tactical measure after tactical measure after tactical measure. And as a consequence of that, you've got, an opportunity in the landscape that now exists for firms, for regulators, and for RegTech sort of companies to come in and help provide some stability and sustainability to that ecosystem that now has been built. Those tactical implementations really aren't sustainable in the longer term. Given that these regulations are unlikely to go away, it's in everybody's interest to build infrastructure that actually is going to last 10, 20 years, because that fundamentally is what the industry needs. There are attempts going on across the regulatory industry to actually sort of start to standardize things. The FSB and IOSCO actually have been doing some work bringing regulators together across the various sort of jurisdictions to try and actually sort of bring some focus to consistency. A lot of focus there has been on the swaps reporting, OTC derivatives, UTI, UPI, and associated data sets. So there is activity going on at that level. How quickly it then gets sort of transposed into national regulations, I guess, is the big question. For many firms, MIFID has dominated the last 18 months. And I'm going to use MIFID as a bit of a case study. It came up in the conversation that we were having on the panel earlier on as, I think, an example of how things could evolve. And so I want to come back to that and focus on the data quality, the data standards aspects of that, and so on. But just to put it into context, MiFID is now 10 months in, a little bit more. It's been a bit of a slow start. There was a big bang on the 3rd of January, and everybody started to sort of try and put all of the processes in place. But the reality is that the data has only really just sort of started to settle down to the point where I think the regulators and the market can start to get real value from it. And there's still some work to go there. It's been a very evolutionary thing as well, right? The SI mandatory regime is only just kicking in for OTC derivatives, which arguably was one of the areas of major focus in March 2019. Up until now, it's been a completely optional thing for systematic internalizers to choose to be an SI in OTC derivatives. And of course, there's still Brexit looming over the whole thing. And for any of you that were watching the news earlier on, Theresa May's draft deal may or may not actually end up sort of getting through the 27 EU countries and the British Parliament. If it doesn't, then the FCA and the European regulators are going to have to do something pretty quickly to try and understand how they actually cooperate going forward. Let's move on to the next slide. As I said, I wanted to try and use MiFID II as a sort of an example, a case study of how a data-intensive sort of focus actually can end up with good results for the industry as a whole. MiFID II was a massive undertaking for the industry. There's no doubt about that at all. And the primary goal of it was transparency. Fundamentally, I guess the conclusion, the political conclusion after the financial crash was that there was not enough transparency in the markets. Therefore, actually, MiFID was all about creating that transparency. And it in particular to the slightly more obscure markets where instruments weren't traded on exchanges and sort of public venues where you could see the results. Very much a focus on fixed income markets, very much a focus on OTC derivative markets. The primary areas of drive, I guess, for that regulation were very much around pre-trade pricing. So publishing prices prior to doing a trade for any instruments that were supposed to be liquid. Post-trade reporting, so shortly after having completed a trade, report that trade out to the market so that the market could see what was actually happening. And then transaction reporting to the regulator within the next 24 hours to make sure that the regulator had a good sort of record of everything that had actually been going on. Now, the interesting thing about this whole approach was the mechanism or the stance that the regulators and then ESMA took. And they basically, as we talked a little bit about on the panel, spent a lot of time driving standards and clarity into the regulations that they were expecting to be put in place. They published a whole range of technical specifications, which we and a lot of others have spent a lot of time over the last sort of 2 years poring over. And those technical specifications essentially defined how data was to be collected. They defined a lot of other things as well, actually, but they defined how data was to be collected, how data was to be used in the market, the approach for trade reporting and standard and transaction reporting and so on. And It was a large amount of data. If you look down the panel on the right-hand side, as of today, there are 10 million tradable products in the ESMA database, active products, each with somewhere in the region of 100 plus attributes. Within our database, we actually store slightly more than that because we derive certain fields as well. But that's a lot of data. Each attribute defined down to a relatively specific level. They didn't get everything right, but they actually went, I would say, 99 point something of the way there. There have been 14 million ISINs issued by the ANA Derivative Service Bureau since the beginning of January. And about 4 million of those have actually then subsequently, those instruments have subsequently been registered on the ESMA database. Should have been a higher number, probably. So that shows that things aren't necessarily working perfectly yet, but again, a lot of instruments. Now, interesting thing is the firms that were involved in actually creating this data and continuing to create it on a day-to-day basis. As a result of MiFID, there are now 120 regulated markets registered, 246 registered MTFs, 78 registered OTFs, and 226 registered systematic internalizers. That's a lot of organizations. Now, not all of them are active, but a lot of them are now actually registering instruments before they're traded in the market, publishing prices, publishing trade reports, and then ultimately transaction reports as well. Registering those instruments is the critical thing, though, right? Because that's where a lot of the standardization and the focus was actually sort of was placed. And the regulators defined how the data was to be collected. These 670 registered institutions are the ones that are actually creating the data. So the data is coming from hundreds of organizations, being collected in a standard way, being run through the various sort of regulators and ESMA's databases, and then made available out to the market for the market to actually sort of use as part of the regulatory obligations. The remarkable thing is actually that the data is as good as it is. And I think that is a real tribute to the regulator, ESMA, in this instance, sort of defining the data down to that level of granularity. The data wasn't perfect at the beginning of the year. It's been, I think, probably 10 months of sort of gradually improving. Not all of the definitions were absolutely perfect either. I mean, we've spent quite a bit of time trying to get some answers out of ESMA around very specific sort of niche derivative products, classifications, and so on. But actually, in the grand scheme of things, it's pretty good. I think where ESMA went too far was that they actually put themselves into the middle of this process. So they're now in a situation where they are the ones collecting the data, the reference data around the market, and they are the ones that are publishing it back out to the market. So those 10 million instruments are going into their database, being published back out by them, and on a daily basis they're collecting more and publishing more out. The challenge they're facing is they're a regulatory organization, they're European funded, they probably don't have the budget they need to really sort of make this work, and to be honest, more than 50% of the time they're actually sort of several hours late in terms of publishing the data. Hopefully that will get better, and the market is actually sort of coping, but in essence that means that the data that they're publishing ends up being a couple of days late, getting out to the market, probably. But all in all, actually, not a bad outcome. But as a consequence of, I guess, that system sort of stabilizing, there's been relatively little focus on the regulator's part in terms of using this data and looking at sort of enforcement actions. They've started to get more interested in the quality of the data. They're starting to push back on firms that are actually registering incorrectly. They're starting to, I'm sure, look at volumes and so on. But the reality is there haven't been any enforcement actions yet, and it's not obvious that there will be any in the near term, because I think everybody is still waiting for things to settle down a bit. Now, I touched on this again earlier as well, actually, as an example of how the industry can work together well. We believe that as the MiFID landscape matures, there will be somewhere near 150 active systematic internalizers. On the previous page, I said there are 226 registered. One of the reasons why there are actually so many more registered is because a lot of firms have now registered for themselves in both the UK and in Europe in fear of Brexit coming along at some point and actually needing them to be a systematic internalizer in both. So not all of those 226 SIs are currently active. We think the number will grow, Brexit aside, to somewhere close to 150 by probably the middle of next year. The growth will be driven to some extent by the mandatory implementation of the SI regime for OTC derivatives. And there will be a lot of firms who get caught by the regulations for probably just a very small number of instruments, likely currency swaps and so on, where they happen to be specialists in their own domestic market. And therefore are quite large volume providers in that particular market. And one of the things that we're doing as a firm is actually sort of setting up to serve those as well as we can, so that it's a relatively straightforward thing for these firms to adopt the MiFID requirements in a small way. What we've done in this particular area is we've worked with a whole range of industry sort of constituents to actually pull together some data that actually was not was omitted from the regulations by mistake. It's a data set that allows you to determine who should trade report in the MiFID context. And who trade reports depends very much on the role that you're playing as a firm. And trade reporting is a single-sided sort of approach in Europe under MiFID II, and therefore it is important to understand your role and your counterparty's role in making that happen. What we've done with this initiative is actually we've collected data from around about 90 systematic internalizers today, number still growing, consolidated that together using the APAs to help that process along. The APAs are the trade reporting entities that are out there in the market sort of supporting the industry. It's been very successful because it's allowed the APAs to trade report effectively for their clients, and it's allowed the systematic internalizers to actually validate that they're, the right thing is going on in their name. The SI registry is actually just going through a little bit of an upgrade because as the OTC derivatives become, as the SI mandatory regime kicks in for OTC derivatives, one of the technical specifications under MiFID requires you to go down to a significant level of detail in classifications for those instruments. We're currently going through quite a bit of work to actually define that granularity, put it into the template, collect that data, literally down to sort of seven layers of classification for some of the OTC instruments. I just thought it was worthwhile touching on what actually needed to be done in each firm in order to actually sort of make this work. It's a little bit from a data perspective because that's the focus that we have as an organization. But on the next slide, I also then want to just sort of touch on how that's been sort of serviced by the market. So has the instrument been traded in Europe before? It's a question you need to